From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump on Tuesday delivered his very first State of the Union address as president. While his address last year at a joint session of Congress was full of ominous warnings, this year Trump tried to paint a rosy picture of the economy while building up immigrants as dangerous bogeymen. Ahead of the speech, Trump's administration remained mired in much controversy, and he went into it with the worst approval rating that the Gallup poll has ever recorded for a president on their one-year anniversary. Although the State of the Union was presented as one where Trump would reach across the aisle to Democrats and focus on an infrastructure plan, the actual speech was lengthy, partisan, and predictable. Today, we'll play you excerpts from the speech and analysis from our correspondent, Rosa Clemente. Rosa Clemente is a community organizer. She's active with Black Lives Matter. She's a freelance journalist. She was the 2008 Green Party vice presidential candidate. She's currently a doctoral candidate in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Welcome back to the program, Rosa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So we had covered the situation in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria with you multiple times. You had traveled there, you have been and still are quite involved with recovery efforts. President Trump, in his address on Tuesday, briefly mentioned Puerto Rico once near the beginning of his address. It was so brief, we won't even bother playing it. Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised that he didn't mention Puerto Rico.
He also barely mentioned the other parts of the country that had been hit hard by climate change. Did not mention once the California wildfires. So let's fill in that vacuum specifically on Puerto Rico. What should have Donald Trump said on Tuesday night about Puerto Rico?
Well, first, he didn't mention anything about climate change or what is happening environmentally. And he embraced, again, a language that says clean coal is an option when we all know that's an oxymoron, especially in light of the continuing climate disasters that are happening here and all over the world. Well, today, Wednesday, today, FEMA is ending all relief around water and food in Puerto Rico. So I think that just shows clearly how Trump and the federal government thinks about us as Puerto Ricans and really does not care that they're in complete violation of human rights against the people of Puerto Rico. When you begin to deny people food and water, what you're basically saying is you're forcing people to either leave the island more en masse or you're straight up killing people because you're starving them. And that's what's happening as of today. So I don't think there's anything he would have said. The only thing I would have wanted to hear is that Puerto Rico deserves a cancellation of the debt, that the United States government owes us money, and that we have to go on the path to free an independent Puerto Rico through a decolonization process supported by the international community.
San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, who I know you had interviewed while in Puerto Rico, was actually a guest of Senator Kirsten Gillibrand at the State of the Union on Tuesday night. Trump trotted out one person after another in the audience and, of course, entirely ignored her presence. She has been pretty active in criticizing him, and she has also very much slammed the decision by FEMA to end its presence in Puerto Rico. The camera didn't even pan to her even once during the speech.
Well, she shouldn't have been there. I mean, I respect Mayor Cruz and the work that she has been doing, but I've been very clear since last year. I don't think anyone who is against racism and white supremacy and Islamophobia and every ism that I could say right now should not even be in the audience. Mm. There were a lot of Democrats yesterday that chose not to be there because they said they couldn't not in good conscience sit there and basically normalize him. So my take is that no Democrat should have been there, and I wish that Mayor Cruz had gone to the State of the Union, one of the many events that was held to counteract President Trump's his State of the Union address, but the state of our union, particularly that Tarana Burke from the Me Too movement, Ai-Jen Poo from the National Domestic Workers Alliance, Monica Ramirez from the Farm Workers Alliance, and Alicia Garza put together. She was invited to that, and I wish she would have taken that invitation like some of the other women of color congressional reps did. And, you know, so that's just something I personally think. I don't think it means that she's not doing great right. work. I think that she has to understand that the Democratic Party here in the United States has been just as complicit in normalizing this president and ignoring what Black and brown people need, not only in the last two years, but in the last 40 to 50 years.
Let's talk about the lie of the economic boom that Trump trotted out on Tuesday night. You know, he came into office promising to lift Americans and promising to be this, you know, using this populist rhetoric. And just 1 year into his presidency, the picture that he painted of the economy sounded so fantastical. So let's actually hear what he had to say on Tuesday night about the economy.
Since the election, we have created 2.4 million new jobs, including 200,000 new jobs in manufacturing alone. Tremendous numbers. After years and years of wage stagnation, we are finally seeing rising wages. Unemployment claims have hit a 45-year low. And something I'm very proud of, African American unemployment stands at the lowest rate ever recorded. And Hispanic American unemployment has also reached the lowest levels in history. Small business confidence is at an all-time high. The stock market has smashed one record after another, gaining $8 trillion and more in value in just this short period of time. The great news for Americans, 401k, retirement pension, and college savings accounts have gone through the roof. And just as I promised the American people from this podium 11 months ago, we enacted the biggest tax cuts and reforms in American history.
And that is President Trump on Tuesday night delivering his first State of the Union address. We edited the applause out for just for time purposes. Rosa Clemente is my guest. If you simply don't read anything else in the news and you are a supporter of Trump and you listen to the story, it sounds amazing. It sounds exciting. And indeed, his supporters are the most optimistic, polls show, about the economy in terms of how they feel. How do you counter everything he said?
I mean, with facts, first those 2.4 million jobs, what kind of jobs? What's the wage? Are these part-time jobs? Are they full-time jobs? Are they jobs with benefits? Because we recently saw Walmart say that it's going to raise the wage for all workers, but at the same time laid off 5,000 workers. So, you know, what these companies are going to do is, yeah, they're going to raise some wages here and there. But in the meantime, they'll continue mass layoffs, mostly of probably younger people, part-time workers, maybe even some full-time workers that have benefits. And then we know that the income inequality gap continues to grow from every indicator we have. We just saw a report, I think it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, that said that there's 81 billionaires that control almost 85% of the wealth in the world. So, you know, I can't believe anything that's coming out of the White House. I don't care how many economic advisors, PhDs they have. They're all working to frame the narrative that Trump and his administration wants to frame, particularly a populist narrative that he's a false populist on top of that. You know, so I think the only thing he can stand on right now is that he secures his base so that his base will come out in the next cycle of elections. You know, I think that means it requires that we figure out on our end why still half of the American people don't participate in the electoral political process. And if the Democrats are going to keep propping up white men like they did last night by having Representative Kennedy, you know, out of that Kennedy kind of lineage and another white man that is going to save the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party thinks that the working class people are all white people, then the Democrats are not going to win the next election. And 2018, the midterms might be a little bit different, but the Trump and his administration is preparing to be president again. So that's why they have to solidify their base with things that are not factual.
What about his touting of African-American unemployment? You heard somebody in the audience kind of scream in excitement about this. And he, ahead of the speech, got into a Twitter war with Jay-Z over unemployment in the African-American community. Why is Trump so excited about touting this, whether or not it's, you know, it actually translates into fact in the community?
Because someone probably fudged those numbers so that he could go out there and say something that we know is not true. And we also know that unemployment does not count people. Those unemployment numbers never count people who are not seeking immediate, if they're not within within an employment office, or if they're not receiving unemployment in insurance. So if you're a part-time worker, you've lost your job, most likely you're not going to receive unemployment, right? That means that you're not being counted in those numbers. There's no way you can tell us, for folks that live in communities of color, that the unemployment rate has dropped so dramatically that it's a new day for African American and Hispanics, when we know in some communities 60 to 70% of Black and Latino people are unemployed. Mm-hmm. And we know that to be a fact.
And so, some are saying that this is just a continuing trend in the economy that began under Obama. How can Trump take credit for something just having been in office for a year? Also, the Congressional Black Caucus, who you might take issue with the fact that they even showed up to the State of the Union, but they sort of sat and very, very grimly when the camera panned to them, and they weren't impressed by him boasting about African-American unemployment.
I mean, he's lying. And this is the thing that, even those that showed up, I think some of us wanted some type of response. How are you just sitting there for an hour and a half? I don't need to see disdain on your face. I need to see disdain by you getting up and walking out, by you interrupting. This idea of decorum and that the institution is more important than the individual that represent it is getting our people more marginalized. It's getting our people killed, essentially. So even those that sat there, I don't want to read commentaries about the face that Nancy Pelosi made or Nydia Velasquez made. Why are you sitting there? I think we have to move this conversation now to like trying to figure out why a white supremacist does what he does, and us figuring out if these are our allies, then what enemies, you know, we might not need any enemies if those are the allies that are supposed to be having our back as the majority of the people in America.
One of the very important points that Trump made last night that it wasn't clear how Democrats in the audience responded was a very clear dig at athletes who have been kneeling during the national anthem. And I want to get into the part of the speech now. We talked about the economic aspect. I want to get into the part of the speech where, after painting a rosy picture of the economy, Trump then created the bogeymen, who were, of course, people of color. This is what he had to say about the national anthem when he trotted out a young white boy who has been apparently putting flags on the graves of veterans.
Here tonight is Preston Sharp, a 12-year-old boy from Redding, California, who noticed that veterans' graves were not marked with flags on Veterans Day. He decided all by himself to change that and started a movement that has now placed 40,000 flags at the graves of our great heroes. Preston, a job well done. Young patriots like Preston teach all of us about our civic duty as Americans. And I met Preston a little while ago, and he is something very special that I can tell you. Great future. Thank you very much for all you've done, Preston. Thank you very much. Preston's reverence for those who have served our nation reminds us of why we salute our flag, why we put our hands on our hearts for the Pledge of Allegiance, and why we proudly stand for the national anthem.
That is Donald Trump on Tuesday night at the State of the Union address, making a very clear reference to his disdain for athletes who have protested against police brutality and other issues by taking a knee during the national anthem. In particular, of course, Colin Kaepernick, whom he didn't mention by name, and all of the others that have followed since Kaepernick. Rosa Clemente, what did you make of this? He went from a kid placing flags at the graves of veterans to standing during the national anthem. And this is a person who showed during the last time he was televised at the national anthem, didn't even remember the words of the song.
Yeah, I mean, look, what Colin Kaepernick has done is take a full hit on his football career, period. On top of that, not only is Colin Kaepernick supporting grassroots organizations throughout the country by continuing to fundraise and donate money, this boycott of the NFL has now seen the NFL reach its lowest numbers since they've been broadcasting. So, I mean, in my opinion, football is a horrible, dangerous sport that actually I don't think any child should be participating in. And now that we know the traumatic brain injuries that come with it, the idea that this is the most edified and, quote, most important sport in the United States is something that needs to be completely rethought. But within 2 years, Colin Kaepernick, as well as many other football players, activists, and organizers that support that specific movement have dealt a blow to the NFL. And I think that's incredible. So I don't expect Trump in any regard to have any respect for organizers, activists, athletes, artists, those of us who speak out. I think it's more incumbent that we as organizers and activists keep supporting, particularly artists and athletes that have names and have platforms and join with them. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's important to point out that the most dangerous rhetoric that Trump put out yesterday was inflating immigrants as gang members.
Yes. In fact, let's get to that.
As gang members.
I think you're absolutely right. It was the most dangerous, most xenophobic part of the speech. And let's play an excerpt of what he said on Tuesday night. He started by trotting out four grieving parents, all people of color.
Struggling communities, especially immigrant communities, will also be helped by immigration policies that focus on the best interests of American workers and American families. For decades, open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities. They've allowed millions of low-wage workers to compete for jobs and wages against the poorest Americans. Most tragically, they have caused the loss of many innocent lives. Here tonight are two fathers and two mothers, Evelyn Rodriguez, Freddie Cuevas, Elizabeth Alvarado, and Robert Mickens. Their two teenage daughters, Kayla Cuevas and Nisa Mickens, were close friends on Long Island. But in September 2016, on the eve of Nisa's 16th birthday. Such a happy time it should have been. Neither of them came home. These two precious girls were brutally murdered while walking together in their hometown. Six members of the savage MS-13 gang have been charged with Kayla and Nisa's murders. Many of these gang members took advantage of glaring loopholes in our laws to enter the country as illegal, unaccompanied, alien minors, and wound up in Kayla and Nisa's high school. Evelyn, Elizabeth, Freddie, and Robert, tonight everyone in this chamber is praying for you. Everyone in America is grieving for you. Please stand. Thank you very much.
And that is Donald Trump on Tuesday night, bringing up the fact that two young girls had been killed by members of the MS-13 gang. I won't play the whole clip. He milked the grief of these four parents for all it was worth. Rosa Clemente, I was really shocked he went that low. I shouldn't have been, but I still was. What about you?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, conflating all undocumented people as illegal aliens, as criminals. In fact, I think what shocked me was when he said American are dreamers too, to take away even the narrative, the great narrative that the dreamers, albeit a bit flawed, that the dreamers have put out there.
And actually, let's play that. I'm so glad you brought that up because I don't know how many people got that.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too.
Americans are dreamers too, said Trump on Tuesday night. He didn't mention the people who identify themselves as dreamers, DACA recipients, not once.
That Stephen Miller definitely wrote that line. Mm-hmm. We have to be clear that Stephen Miller wrote that line, and that's to snatch away the organizing and activism and narrative that DACA recipients have built, okay? And that is, it is completely dangerous, as well as conflating, as we were saying before, MS-13, a gang that actually did not exist until the United States began its dirty wars in Latin America, that forced many El Salvadorian and other Central Americans to come here. And then once those people that became gang members, a small group, began to be deported, they now have to find a way to live in these dangerous countries, right? So the policies of America is really what ends up creating MS-13, which MS-13, you know, as horrible a gang as they are, when we look at the numbers, you can't compare what MS-13 gang members are doing even to current statistics around murder and the most egregious crimes that are happening in America. It's not MS-13 that is going out there just straight murdering people left and right and all these things that they're saying MS-13 is doing.
I mean, look at gun violence, domestic violence. All of those issues.
Yeah, you can look at that number every day. Mm-hmm. And that's not to give a pass to MS-13. It's to say that when you then begin to say that at any given moment, particularly Latino undocumented people could be potential gang members, then you have dehumanized these people even more, which makes it easier to round up, makes it easier to deport people, makes it easier basically to disappear people. It makes it easier to detain them without any, you know, without any cause. And we're going to see that happening more and more as Trump and his administration has said they want to order more. I mean, they want to hire more border agents and ICE agents, right? And then, of course, he has to use people of color. And that's what he did. He's subtly, if people didn't pick up, is now pitting particularly African Americans against undocumented, specifically Latino, Latina, Latinx people.
And I'm not sure if those four parents he brought up were Afro-Latinos. They had Latino-sounding names. They appeared African-American. But you're right. I was sort of shocked at how he was doing this. A lot of the people he brought up who were in the audience were people of color.
Yeah, and then he also said when he was talking about the unemployment rate, you know, going down, at one point, I think somewhere in there, he had said, because jobs belong to real Americans. Mm. And within the African American and Latinx community, those are tensions that organizers and activists deal with a lot. Specifically, there could be some African Americans that believe that, quote, Latinos are taking your job. And then there's Latinos, Latina, and Latinx that sometimes participate in anti-Black behavior and sentiment against African Americans. As organizers and activists, we do the work of undoing that work on a daily basis, all of us as Black and brown people. So for him as a white supremacist to put out then a narrative that is pitting Black and brown against each other, that trickles down. It might not trickle down into our silos where we're doing media work and we're organizers and activists and we're at rallies and all of that, but that kind of rhetoric trickles down to people. And that starts to play out in very dangerous ways. So, you know, I believe that what we saw yesterday was, again, white supremacy, not only on display, but white supremacy normalized again and codified in a way that we didn't think was possible.
And then Trump went on to talk about his immigration proposal that he's put forward, saying he's made great concessions to Democrats in offering a pathway to citizenship for 1.8 million undocumented youth. We've actually done in-depth analysis of that immigration plan on our program. But I just want to play for you a couple of the clips, two out of the 4 points that he made around immigration, his four pillars. One was around the diversity visa lottery, and the other was around so-called chain migration. Here again is Donald Trump on Tuesday night at the State of the Union address.
The third pillar ends the visa lottery, a program that randomly hands out green cards without any regard for skill, merit, or the safety of American people. It's time to begin moving toward a merit-based immigration system. One that admits people who are skilled, who want to work, who will contribute to our society, and who will love and respect our country. The fourth and final pillar protects the nuclear family by ending chain migration. Under the current broken system, a single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. Under our plan, we focus on the immediate family by limiting sponsorships to spouses and minor children. This vital reform is necessary not just for our economy, but for our security and for the future of America.
And that is Donald Trump on Tuesday night at the State of the Union address talking about two aspects of his immigration plan. First, the issue of the diversity visa lottery, Rosa, where he essentially said it would have to be a merit-based system. I mean, if it were the case, I imagine that we might see lots and lots of Indians and Chinese people who have IT skills being let into the country, who are among some of the same people that Trump's anti-immigrant base rails against. And also on the issue of so-called chain migration, unlimited numbers of people being allowed to be sponsored. I wish that were the case because I would love to bring some of my relatives here. But of course, that's not true. And didn't chain migration help Trump bring in his own relatives? Let's talk about the hypocrisy of some of the statements he just made.
I mean, you know, those are all dog whistles. And what with the chain migration, what he's basically saying, look, we got to stop these black and brown people from bringing in more black and brown people and from having babies. I mean, that's essentially what he's saying. And then with the visa lottery, you know, besides the fact that he would be more privy to maybe having people coming from India or China that have the ability to have more technical skills when there's such a gap in the United States of technology jobs that exist. But unfortunately, the education system here is not particularly preparing young black and brown people to fill those jobs. He's also saying that he wants white migration. He wants Europeans wherever white folks are coming from majority white countries, that's merit-based. What then is the merit? How do you measure that? And the idea that people can just easily immigrate into the United States when they do it, you know, by going through every checklist that the government puts up, immigration period is not easy.
What did he mean by saying he wanted to protect? What did he mean by saying he wanted to protect the nuclear family from chain migration? He wants to protect an immigrant like me from my own parents or my own, you know, siblings?
Or what did he mean by nuclear? Like, what, the man, woman, and 2.5 mm-hmm. children? Like, what don't we understand that we know people in our lives that have had green cards and been trying to become citizens for the entire time that they've been here. Yeah. And every time there's a level that changes, or some people get caught up with lawyers that basically don't do the work or don't file the paperwork, or people are working just to pay fees to become a citizen. So his disdain and his hate for the other outside of the United States is clear. And then his disdain for the other within the United States is clear. He's seeking to close off this country for more black and brown people. And at the same time, him and his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, are seeking to contain black and brown people in this country and contain them in a very 1984 George Orwellian way of surveillance. And that's what they're moving towards. And that's what a lot of his rhetoric essentially means. And we know what it means. So if we know what it means, then we know what the average white supremacist in America is going to do and run with this kind of rhetoric.
Well, finally, Rosa, we don't have much time left, so I won't play the lengthy part of his speech where he painted all of the enemies outside the country. But let me just summarize. After he created the image of the demons domestically that white Americans should fear from, he went on to talk about ISIS, North Korea, wanting to end the military sequester, keeping Guantanamo open, trotted out a Korean... And went on at length about North Korea and Iran. Now this is an interesting part of the speech, because this is where Democrats and Republicans tend to be in lockstep with one another. When he brought up the enemy combatants term, and when he raised the issue of Guantanamo, those weren't his creations, right? They were the creations of George W. Bush, and then Obama continued them. So he is able to continue it too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should also be mindful that he said, right, that we need more nuclear proliferation. And I just never thought I'd be living in a time period where I would actually have to have deep, intense conversations with my daughter, who's 13, about the threat of a nuclear war. We saw a false alarm happen in Hawaii. We saw how ill-prepared we are for something that could potentially annihilate the world. And the fact that both parties think that in a way is okay, that having more, quote, enemy combatants put into Guantanamo Bay, who are those enemy combatants? They could be people outside of the United States, but we can't also forget that Jeff Sessions, the FBI has declared black identity extremists as a threat to the United States, that they've declared Puerto Rican independence thought leaders a threat, that they've declared environmental justice people who are organized as a threat. So what is an enemy combatant? It's not only someone outside of the United States. With Jeff Sessions, with the FBI, with him threatening to fire federal workers. I mean, I thought that too was something like,
right.
Whoa.
He brought like that up, yeah.
Basically said he wants his cabinet members to be able to fire anyone. What he's really saying is anyone that doesn't agree with their policies. We're talking about federal workers that are supposed to be the most protected workers, and he went in on them. So I think we have to be take this, break it down the way we're doing it, and figure out how we're going to organize a little bit differently so that people fully understand the threat that we are under by this administration and those that seek to find common ground and those that sit and in my eye or my opinion are also complicit with what this administration is bringing down on us.
I think the point you made earlier about normalizing this presidency is a really critical one. As we analyze the speech, we absolutely do not want to normalize everything that Trump stands for and everything that he said, because even though other presidents have stood in the same place and even on the surface of it, spoken some similar sounding words and appeared to be similar, everything that has happened in the past year is absolutely unprecedented in our lifetime, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think we have to really take them at their word, that we have to tune out mainstream media if people are still tuning in, and go to other media sources. And people have to be part of some organized effort in their community, and that all our organizing effort can't just go into the marching into the hands of the Democrats or just worrying about who we're going to vote in and out of office. Because unfortunately, even the people we vote in that are supposed to have our back, the idea that any one of them thinks that sitting down with him at any point could garner us anything good is problematic. We saw the Democrats last week sell out the Dreamers. We saw Schumer and 32 other Senate Democrats vote to reopen the federal government and throw DACA recipients, AKA the Dreamers, under the bus when many of them would not be in office, including Doug Jones, if it wasn't for Black women and for the efforts of undocumented young people organizing their asses off the last 5 to 7 or almost a decade now in this country. And this is what the Senate Democrats did. So if the Senate Democrats are gonna throw us under the bus, there is no hope in any of these Republicans to ever work with them or have any common ground with them.
Well, Rosa Clemente, I wanna thank you very much for joining us today and spending this time with us. Really appreciate your analysis.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Rosa Clemente. She's a community organizer, active with Black Lives Matter, freelance journalist, and the 2008 Green Party vice presidential candidate. She's currently a doctoral candidate in the W.E.B. Du Bois Department of Afro-American Studies at University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's also a news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. We've been discussing Donald Trump's first State of the Union speech given Tuesday night. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.